Thank you for the introduction.
I'd like also to say thank you
to the Quantico folks for putting this together. This is a wonderful meeting. I've been talking to lots of people who have something in mind which seems to be common to all of us. Let's look for a brighter future. How can we achieve that? I think we can achieve it by working together, and I'll talk some more about that later. What I am proposing to do today is to talk about global consciousness, an idea that it really is now ready for us to take on. What it's referring to is an interconnection of minds, and in Teilhard de Chardin's term, it's a noosphere, a layer of knowing or intelligence for the earth. In Teilhard's idea, in his description of what it means to be human and what evolution amounts to, it, he said that we have another stage to go, that we are well advanced, but that we will become what we're supposed to become in the next phase, and that is a layer of intelligence to take care of the earth, to care for the earth. In the publicity and the brochure from Quantica, there was a description of the Global Consciousness Project saying that these studies indicate or suggest that there is indeed a global consciousness. That's what I want to be talking about today, partly because if this is so, we should be asking ourselves, do we create through our collective group intelligence something that is the reality? That are we creating the world in which we live? Could we, through our association with each other, bring about fundamental change in the world as we know it? I think many of us believe that fundamental change is not a bad idea. It's time for some fundamental changes. So I'm going to give you a little background, talk about the evidence that this global consciousness actually exists. And then toward the end of my time, we'll be talking about what it means. What are the implications in some depth? I worked in Princeton University in what was called the Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory for a little over 20 years. And we did experiments asking whether human consciousness can interact with the world in the form of physical devices, physical systems of various kinds. One we used a lot, we called a random event generator. It was a pretty good sized device, a box like a suitcase, sitting on a table, and people would sit near that, but have no connection to it, no wires, no direct connection at all, and you'd be given the task of changing how that machine would work, make it change so that it produced high numbers when that was the instruction, low numbers when that was the instruction. And that experiment worked. We were able to show, in not only that experiment, but several others that were related to it, that if you intend that the world, in the form of this device, that the world should change, it will change. It might be a small difference, but it's a real difference. This is a picture of results from that very experiment, the one pictured before, where people were asked to produce high numbers. And in the case of being asked to produce high numbers, they did. What's normal is for the numbers to be not very much different from what's expected. I'll give you a little bit more of an idea of what's expected. And when people were asked to produce low numbers, they could do that too. And moving on to how this kind of machine works, or what a random number generator is, many people think of a computer program, but that's not what we were using. Instead, we were using a physical device. It was deeply buried in that box on the table. And I'll show you pictures of simpler, smaller ones that we use nowadays. They all are based, the ones we used, on electron tunneling. That's a quantum effect. And this is a kind of graphic that might give you some idea. We set up a circuit that's driving electrons against a barrier.
that white bar in the middle is a barrier in a diode. A diode, you may know, is a switch that allows electrons to flow one way, but prevents them from flowing the other way. But electrons are, they have a mind of their own, so to speak, and so they, some of them, penetrate the barrier. And I don't know if you can see it, but there's a tiny, faint cloud on the other side of the barrier, where by classical standards, nothing should appear. What does appear there is a tiny voltage that we sample. And when it's a high, when that voltage is a fairly high level, we say that's a one. If it's a low level, we say it's a zero. And we wind up with a completely unpredictable quantum-based sequence of random numbers, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. Humans can't produce random numbers very well, but these devices produce exactly, theoretically, effective random numbers. And remember, the important definition is that a sequence of random numbers has, in effect, no future that's been determined. It's a sequence where nobody, not even the machine that's producing it, can give any indication of what the future will be like. Here's what such data might look like if you would just graph them. Take 1,000 trials, and what we usually call a trial is 200 samples. Basically like flipping 200 coins and counting how many heads. You expect that will be about 100 most of the time, and in fact, if you gather lots of these data samples, you'll find that there's a distribution that looks just like the famous bell curve. There's a mean value that's 100. Exactly half of them should be and ones, and half should be zeros. So, but there's also some variation. It's not 100 all the time. It might be 97 or 92 or 114. It gets increasingly rare as you get further from the mean. So you get that shape, and you probably, if you're looking at either of these graphs, you say, well, how is anybody going to tell if there's really been a change? You couldn't, unless it was a big change. So we use a particular kind of graphic to show the development over time of a sequence of random numbers, and we do this in both baseline or calibration conditions, which produces something that looks like this, a random walk that has a level trend. It doesn't tend to go up or down particularly. It just wanders about, as some people say, like a drunk trying to get home. This is what the ones we use nowadays look like. When we started in 1980, there were hardly any computers except room-sized computers. As technology advanced, we were able to shrink that suitcase-sized device into something that easily fits into your hand, and we did that partly so that we could give other people this equipment so they could try the same kinds of experiments. And what we do with these in many of the experiments is to produce a continuous sequence of data, and there is an index that goes along with that so that we can see exactly what kind of numbers were produced at any given time. In other words, we can create an experimental situation that we can use for a variety of different kinds of experiments. The early ones just ask, could my intention change the way the device operates? But we decided at some point it would be a pretty good idea to go out into the field, and especially into places where we might find groups who were coming together and actually becoming, in a sense, resonant with each other. They would be participating in perhaps a ritual or all enjoying an incredibly beautiful concert. So that the idea was that in such a situation, we would find the development of something we could call group consciousness. And in that kind of situation, this was a name that we applied to the idea early on. Perhaps we could see signs of something we've been hearing about already today, something like a consciousness field. We also, because we're always doing science, we did some things in mundane situations to make sure that it wasn't just the machine going wrong. But in a busy train station or a street corner, you wouldn't expect any kind of coherence among the people who happen to be wandering through. Instead, there would be a kind of chaotic non-interaction, something like an interpenetration without interaction. And we found that indeed, in such situations, the level random walk would be the result. But let me show you what we find in numinous situations, or situations where a kind of group coherence or resonance might develop. Two examples. On the left is a beautiful natural monument in northeastern Wyoming. It's a volcano which erupted millions of years ago and left a column of lava inside the mountain. The mountain was softer than the lava, and the millions of years eroded away everything but that central column, which is a very impressive and quite beautiful monument that the North American Native Americans thought of as a kind of sacred place. We went there with a shaman, a native Shoshone shaman from that area, whose mission, among other things, was to heal any spiritual wounds that might have been suffered over the time, uncaring people coming to visit. And he found a power spot as we walked around this place and produced and did a ceremony for 20 minutes. He chanted and sang and drummed and smoked a mixture of herbs, and I have no idea what was in the mixture, but it was effective. Here, instead of the expected level random walk, we see something that goes strikingly far outside those bounds. And in fact, the shaman whom I had attempted to explain what we were doing said, when he looked at this graph, "Ah, at last I understand." Then I went with a group of 19 spiritually interested people to Egypt, and among other things, we visited the Great Pyramid, had an opportunity to go inside, and this is the result of, this is the data taken and marked in the index with the beginning and end of certain segments. The very first segment here is the entrance tunnel. And you can see there's very little tendency for that to deviate from the random walk we expect. Then we went to the Queen's Chamber here and the Grand Gallery. If you've ever been there, you know that's a pretty impressive place. And if you haven't been there, and do go check it out. It's really quite remarkable. These data are remarkable too. They're so far from flat, so far from normally random, that you have to draw the conclusion, or at least lean toward the conclusion, that our resonant group consciousness, which we felt, was felt also by this random number generator attached to a palm top cube computer I was carrying. And we did a couple of meditations in the King's Chamber, and then after that we wandered out and did our normal kind of stuff. To me, one of the most remarkable experiences, and in terms of this particular experiment, one of the most remarkable databases. We went to all of the ruined temples that we could go to, and in those places, almost always, we also found these strong effects. So I've been talking about now two different kinds of experiment. In the laboratory for about 12 years, we did these random number generator experiments. And they showed, without any real question, if you believe that we were doing our job well as scientists, that conscious intention can change the behavior of a physical device, a random number generator. And then we did several more years of experiments which were showing that that something like group consciousness exists, and that it also has effects in the world. So we were, in effect, ready for a new, to think about a new kind of experiment. And the question that we wanted to ask was, could a world-spanning network of these same devices installed in locations all around the world, could they possibly constitute an instrument that we could use to ask a question about global consciousness? Not just a small group, but in some sense, all of us, or at least very large numbers of us, operating together as a kind of huge group consciousness. We did a couple of prototypes before actually entering into this, and one of the first attempts was during Princess Diana's funeral, everyone was, we were hearing that many hundreds of millions of people, if not a couple of billion people, would be paying attention at the same time to this, what turned out to be 6 hour long funeral ceremony. And you can see a red line here, which is the composite of 12 data lines, data sequences connected, always from well-made random number generators by my friends and colleagues in Europe and the US. They, that's a 100-to-1 odds that we should get any such large deviation by chance. There's a little cloud of green or bluish lines that shows what chance actually produces. So this and other work like it gave us the courage to go ahead and build a network. And over the years, we've had more than 100 of these instruments installed in around the world. You can see that there are some places which are kind of bare. That's because there's either very little internet or very little infrastructure to keep the electricity and therefore your computer running. We're missing Siberia, much of Africa, and Greenland. And we also have, even though a couple of people have offered, we have none in Antarctica either. So this is what the data look like when they come in. It's a mess. It's a chaotic rumble. But by appropriate use of statistics, we can begin to pull that chaotic incoming data set apart and look at all the accumulating deviations for the individual devices and then make an average of those, which is not so easy to see, but it's this dark line here. That's the average accumulating deviation across all of the devices that are sending their data to the server in Princeton. We call that line a cumulative deviation. It just means that we're adding for each second, that's the time interval between our samples, the deviation from 100, which is the expected value. If it's 102, our line goes up by 2 notches. If it's 98, it goes down from there by 2 notches and back to 100, and so on, until you get a history of the accumulating deviation. That's a picture I'll show you in many repetitions later. There are lots of ways to look at the data, and some of them very pretty, but they don't tell us much. It's hard to see any great detail there, even if we have a powerful event. This is a great earthquake in Turkey. This is now so long ago, most of us have forgotten it, even though many thousands of people died in this earthquake and there was tremendous destruction. We might imagine that one or another of those peaks there represents something happening, but the truth is it's really hard to make out any scientific conclusion from data like that. So we use this cumulative deviation picture to represent the history of the data during the time that we say the event is that we're interested in takes place. In the left-hand larger graph, there is a sequence that appears indeed to have, at least part of the time, a fairly strong trend away from the expected random walk. On the right, there are two examples of what we think of as kind of baseline or background events. So we'll go straight to the scientific hypothesis that we use for this experiment. It's fairly straightforward and simple, but it's also a little bit vague, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. But the hypothesis that we have in mind is that events which really focus the attention of large numbers of people around the world, that such events will correlate with changes in our data. Our data will change during those events, and the data will be collected from our whole network of random number generators. That that general hypothesis needs to be instantiated more specifically, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But basically, we're using the same tools as we developed in the laboratory. We're making what my son decided we should call an electrogyogram. It's as if it were an electroencephalogram for the human, but now we've got the Earth body, so we call it an electrogyogram. Consequently, we refer to that network sometimes as the EGG network, EGG. The people are volunteers from all around the world, lots of scientists, lots of artists and businessmen, a variety of people. All that's really required is the dedication to keep a computer running for years and years. The method we use is to identify events that we really think ought to bring us all together, to share emotions, to be deeply engaged somehow. And the question, are we able to catch a little bit of an indication that there's such a thing as global consciousness? So we look at a variety of different kinds of events, natural disasters like earthquakes and floods, accidents, occasionally a plane will crash and 200 or 300 people will be killed and we'll be shocked. Terrorist attacks are even more shocking, and although they've become so, we've become inured to them almost. Major political events. We also look at positive things like great or religious or other celebrations, and things like global demonstrations for peace or a brighter future, that sort of thing. And I'm going to show you a number of examples. We always make a hypothesis ahead of time before looking at the data so we can actually do statistics and interpret the statistics in a reliable way. All that means is that we have to say, this is the event, name it and identify it, put it into a prediction registry, and say, when does it begin, when does it end? And we have a fairly standard amount of time. We know we need several hours, so we usually set something like 6 hours if we can. About many of the times, we don't see much in the way of results that would add to the evidence, but in about 70% of the events that we pick, instead of only 50%, the result goes in the direction that we predict. And it turns out that something like close to 20% are significant in the standard fashion, where you should expect to see only 5%. So I'm going to run through a few examples and then talk more generally about the results. This is the earthquake in Haiti a couple of years ago, actually 3 years ago now. This killed, we had a Haitian driver for the taxi that took us to the train, that took us to the airport. And I asked him if he had heard recently what the total number of people killed. He said nearly 400,000 people. So this was a huge event. And it shows a very strong deviation. This happens to be opposite the direction we normally predict. And so it counts against our bottom line, but it's still, I think, unquestionably a deviation compared with what's expected. There are other ways to look at the data, and this is one which shows an enormous spike in our data, which is in random number generators placed around the world. Our data show a very striking, powerful spike right at the time of the quake. And then this is now 2 days rather than only a few hours. As time goes on, we see many, many large spikes in the data, which corresponds to the understanding that grows after a disaster like that, how bad it is. This is something a little more positive or happy in terms of outcome. In Chile, there was a collapse in a mine, and some 33 miners were confined, I guess, hundreds of meters below the ground and thought to be lost. But the people worked hard to rescue them, and this is the first 2 hours after it was apparently going to be possible they were rescued. The red curve, by the way, shows all of the data. And sorry about that. The green curve shows the data just from one of our devices in Santiago, in a local device relative to the earthquake. The second graph there shows the data over a period of 17 hours, which was the time it took to get all those miners up out of the ground. And you can see a continuous steady trend there. But as somebody, as many of us recognize, one of the major events that brought huge numbers of people to feel the same emotions was the attacks in New York and Washington on September 11th, 2001. we usually just call it 9/11, there were two plane crashes and two building collapses and a couple of other incidents, including attack on the Pentagon. This is a picture of the data over a period of 9 days with 9/11, just this little black box in the middle showing where all that stuff was happening. At first, our prediction, our original prediction, showed a significant deviation, but people said, well, for such a big thing, it should have been a bigger deviation than that, shouldn't it? And who knows what it should be? Well, what it turns out in our explorations was that the deviations continued for about 2 days. It wasn't just a little blip, but a long, long chain of sequential changes in the data. Here's a completely independent measure looking at the same period of time. This is showing just 3 days with 9/11 in the center, and the major events are right here. And you can see that there's a big change in the data that starts a few hours early. So many people, including me, wonder why that would be. There are a couple of possible explanations. One of them is a very straightforward idea that there were perhaps 50 or 100 people, the terrorists in organization, who knew about this, and 20 or so who were preparing to die, and they were saying their prayers to Allah probably about the time that data started changing. My preferred explanation is different. We have premonitions. A very good research shows that human beings sometimes dream, or even in the daytime, somehow come to expect something that does indeed happen. It's we call it premonitions or precognitions. Why wouldn't that happen also to a larger scale group consciousness? We can't, at this point, find any way to distinguish between those options, but I think both of them should be considered. A couple more ways of looking at the data. This is just the major spikes that happened around the time. The data changed, there's no question about it. But by far, for me as a kind of statistician, the most persuasive example or data set is what we call autocorrelation. One of the definitions of random sequences is that there's no relationship between one moment and the next moment. There's no predictability. If you know what has happened now, you don't know what happens in the future, normally. But it turns out that on 9/11, there is a predictability in an autocorrelation that persists for about 2 hours. In other words, the data are not normal random data, and it shows very clearly in this graph, where the red line is the real data, the black cloud shows what random data would do. Moving on to another terrible disaster, we look at the great tsunami in Japan. Again, we have the whole network shown in the red trace, which doesn't look terribly impressive here, but I'll show you more figures later. Our local egg in Japan had a huge deviation. If we look at a longer period of time, you can see that trends that are beginning around the quake persist for a long time. This is a very strong, unusual, or unlikely curve for random data. It looks very much like something we found when we looked at all big earthquakes over a period of about 8 years. In general, there's a change in this particular statistic that starts happening a few hours before the earthquake. It gets to its most extreme value, the low point, right at the time of the quake, and then comes back to normal in the next few hours. It almost looks like we could build a machine to predict earthquakes. It isn't quite as simple as that, but maybe as we learn more, that could happen. Here are some other pictures of the data in Japan. Again, right at the time of the quake, there's a huge spike. A little later, there's an even bigger one, which might possibly represent the fact that we're beginning to understand the true magnitude of the disaster that's ongoing. And here's yet another. It's possible to look with many different statistics at these data. What we're showing here is that no matter how you look, there's something unusual going on in the data represented during that during a disaster like that, which engages so many of us, millions of us, in the same thoughts, which include things like fear and sadness and compassion for the people that are affected. This is another kind of example, a little smaller scale, but still a disaster. In Russia, there was a takeover of a school. Ultimately, 150 people, hostages, were killed in that situation. And it looks almost as if the world, and maybe in the form of our instrument, were paying attention. Here's another example when I don't know how widespread these events, how widespread the coverage is, but you may have heard about the shooting in a theater, the first showing of a new Batman movie. Some crazed person brought an automatic weapon in and just killed as many people as he could in the audience. That's what the data looked like during that event. More recently, we had a disaster in Connecticut where 20 children, 5-6-year-old children, were slaughtered by another crazy person. That's the data developing over time as the news of that disaster increased. When the Tibetans rioted or demonstrated against the Chinese occupation, the world took notice in this form. Here's, again, the other end of the spectrum. We're looking at positive events sometimes. This is the Kumbh Mela, which is an enormous celebration of in the Hindu religion, as many people as can, which turns out to be 10, maybe 20 million, some say more than that, pilgrimage to the Ganges and bathe to cleanse themselves of all sins. And this is a repeated event. So we've looked at it 3 times in the last several years. And it's a little unusual for us to have such an obvious replication, but this is what we're actually looking for. We repeat this experiment time and time and time again, and our hope is that even though the system is very noisy, it's hard to find, it's like we're looking for a goldfish in a kind of choppy sea. By repeating this experiment, we gradually build up some evidence that there really is a goldfish. This is another celebration, you might say, even though it's a funeral. People highly respected Pope John II, and this is the data line during his funeral. Much more recently, we were greatly surprised by the resignation of Pope Benedict, an event that was basically unique in anybody's memory, because nothing like this had happened for, 600 years or something. And then after that, a new pope was appointed. This isn't as strong, but it is a positive outcome, in fact, larger than our average effect size. And we can hope that the newly elected pope will help bring compassion into favor as an emotion that humans might share with each other. Most people think when they hear about this project that sporting events, especially big ones like the World Cup, really ought to just knock the socks off our system, but they don't. We don't know exactly why, but the standard measure typically produces this kind of outcome, which is not very, very much different from chance expectation. It's possible that we haven't figured out the right question to ask. We haven't found the right statistical measure. But it's also possible that it really is a matter of a different kind of event. There's lots of excitement, but there's no compassion, and there really isn't much in the way of resonance and coherence amongst the people, even though they are all enjoying the game. Meditation. Lots of people gather together and organize as many people, friends and strangers, as possible to do meditations on peace or a bright future, whatever. This is one of many examples. It happens to be an unusually strong one. Of course, I picked it out for that reason. But here's a different one. This is a relatively small number, but these are transcendental meditation cities the advanced meditators. People have been meditating for years and years, all working, all doing the same thing, which is just sitting. They're not trying to accomplish anything, but there has been some indication that when there are a number of people focused in meditation, that their calm will spread out and change the way the social matrix around them is operating. So things like accident reports and gun shootings and so forth diminish. That's the evidence for that is pretty good. The evidence that it affects our system is also fairly strong. And speaking of great celebrations, probably one of the greatest is New Year's. Even in countries that have, or cultures that have a different New Year's, I think lots and lots of people pay attention to the transition from December 31st to January 1st. And if we look at all the time zones and we stack them up, we can look at a period of time right around midnight and ask, is that different from normal? And this is a kind of composite that shows you what that might look like. Here's real data from 1 year, a particularly clear version that representing our prediction, which is that this measure will decrease the variance, the variability of our data will decrease around midnight. And this is a beautiful picture of a decrease that maximizes or comes to its most extreme value right at midnight. It's as if the people gathered gradually calm the system, calm themselves, and become attuned to each other, and maybe lift a glass or give somebody a hug right at midnight. This is what it looks like if you look across all the years. It's not as sharply focused, but you can see that there's a diminished variance right around midnight. Now, here's another kind of occasion that's often repeated. In fact, every year there will be an International Peace Day. It's always on the same day, so it's easy to make a prediction that we will see a change in our data on that day due to the fact that millions of people are thinking, let's have peace on this particular day. It doesn't always work. Sometimes our predictions are simply not borne out. But it works more often than not, to the point where we have, over time, a fairly strong indication that there is a consistent deviation during the times that we have picked as times when people will come together. Lots of examples of when people come together and feel compassion or exhibit compassion seem to be effective in changing the data that we have in our database. I think, and there's lots of reason to believe this, that compassion as an emotion is one of the most powerful drivers of the effects that we see. I'll talk a little bit more about it, but it makes sense in a certain way. Compassion is something that really is defined by an interconnection of people with each other. This is what the bottom line looks like for our data over large number, almost 15 years. It's very scattered looking. It probably isn't terribly impressive because there's only a small difference between the grand mean of the data and what's expected. But that small difference is repeated on average so many times that if we use the same representation of the cumulative deviation, we see that there's a huge departure from expectation. In fact, the probability is 10 to the minus 12. That's a lot of zeros followed by a one. We can also talk about the amount of deviation in terms of a z-score, or what people refer to as sigma. We have a 7-sigma effect, and in the hard scientists, most people say, well, if you get around 5 or 6 sigma, then we pay attention. But I think it's time to pay attention to these data. Lots of people ask reasonably enough, what do you do for controls? And this is a picture of control data, which are random samples from a distribution just like the one that we should be seeing in our experiment. And you can see there's a cloud of gray lines here, which is the background against which this might be compared. There's a huge difference, it's an unmistakable difference. So what kinds of things make a difference? What's important in this experiment? Events which engage really large numbers of people are, should, we think, produce larger effect, and they do. There's statistically a significant difference. Positive and negative events, sometimes people say, well, don't positive events have stronger effects? Turns out that both positive and negative events have similar size effects. People are a little surprised, but when we think about the fact that compassion might be determinant, you have compassion during a tragedy, even though it's a negative event, the emotion that brings us together may be something more positive. Intense or unique or shocking or surprising events are much more likely to produce effects than things that we've become accustomed to. It seems that there is a requirement for a kind of mass consciousness. We have to work together to produce these effects. Powerful emotions help, and I think it's also necessary that there be something like an experimenter effect. We have to expect that this can work. Otherwise, we wouldn't be asking the question. I want to show you just a few cases of subsets where we can think in terms of replications of an experiment that are much closer to each other. So when Obama, now President Obama, won the nomination, we predicted that there would be a pretty strong effect, and sure enough, there was a huge effect. And then when he made his acceptance speech, another large effect and so forth, when he was inaugurated, turns out that the effect was backwards, but who knows exactly what that means. Let me go back to that and just remark that over time we have had something like 15 events where Obama and his presence on this world stage was very important. It seems a fairly strong curve, and it's beginning to level off. Maybe. We don't know. It may take another positive trend later, but we'll see. If we look at another politician, and probably most of you have never heard of him, this is a man named Manny Pacquiao. He's from the Philippines, and he's extremely well-known and very popular in the Philippines. And he's not only a politician, but an accomplished boxer. He is a world champion boxer. So we looked at all his boxing matches, and sure enough, they're almost all positive outcomes. This one is a really large database. It's 110 events, which you can think of as checking or looking at global harmony. Peace, prayers, meditations of various kinds, and so forth. This is put together by a colleague named Brian Williams. He just gathered all of those events and asked, what's the trend like? And this is, in this graph, as the ones we've looked at before, the expected data line should be a wandering, random walk down at this level baseline. That's not what we see. This has five parts in 10,000. This is a very unlikely accumulation. So what we think about when we're praying or meditating or when we're working together, when we're wishing that our political world would be more constructive and less destructive, it works. It works in such a small way that we can't necessarily see it, but there is an effect on a completely physical, abstract system of that kind of work. So probably our politicians and business leaders and so forth are even more sensitive to the wishes and prayers of all of us than a random number generator. So we should, I think, feel empowered, maybe even responsible to think positively about the future. I want to take now just a moment for a really very much larger perspective. And this is not a picture of any particular event. This is a picture of all the data for 12 years, I guess. In other words, this is not looking at the effect of events. This is just looking at the data as an effect or a kind of representation of history, you might say. So what we see is an early positive trend and a peak right around 9/11. And then a long, 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 long 8 years long trend, which is significant statistically. And we might ask, you know, what's going on? What could possibly correlate with that? And there are lots of things we could think, like sunspots doesn't work. Social measures might. And one we looked at, which I find very interesting, and this is very selective, is presidential approval rating. We don't have it for this whole period of time, but what we see is a very high and almost precise correspondence of peaks or spikes in the presidential approval rating with some of these historical events. The Iraq War begins and so on, but there's a generally a parallel trend in this social measure with this completely arbitrary data set. We can categorize the data and the events in many different ways, and this just shows the effect size for a variety of different a set of choices. War matters, political events seem to matter, accidents and meditation events and so forth, demonstrations. But we get down to the far end, and the average effect size for these group subsets of data aren't strong enough to be significant, even though they're still positive. Here's a representation graphically of the number of people involved. The more people involved, the larger the effect. Here is something I think in a certain sense should be obvious given our hypothesis. If people are gathered and made coherent in a certain sense by commonly felt emotions, mutually shared ideas or emotions, then the effect might be greater. And so here we're looking at the level or strength of emotion. The stronger the emotion, and this is just arbitrary or ratings by people, it's a subjective rating, but people go through the list and say, does this one represent a high or a low or a medium level of emotion? Then we have the question of positive and negative events. As I mentioned, there's no difference between the positive and negative events. They both produce effects. But before I show the next slide, I want to note this quote from the Dalai Lama. He says, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. And here's a kind of graphic evidence that what he says is true. The effect of compassion, when it's evoked strongly or powerfully, is much greater in our data than when there's little or no compassion. I very recently updated this analysis. That's from 2 or 3 years ago. Now the effect is even stronger. There's a few parts in 1,000 that this could be chance. The difference seems to be real. So what characterizes these effects? This is sort of technical stuff, and I'll just run through it quickly. The primary effect that we're talking about turns out to be not these devices being pushed individually, but instead being pushed to be correlated with each other. Instead of completely random relationship of the data from one and another, they begin to wave in synchrony. During the events when human consciousness is powerfully coordinated or coherent. This measure is positive at the level of this famous Six Sigma, or seven. There is an independent kind of correlation that is like a variance compared with a mean shift, and that's also strongly positive, marginally significant. Both these kinds of mean shift in the pairwise correlation, the variance in the pairwise correlation, those both show autocorrelation. Remember this thing that defines in its absence true random events? We find correlation in the data that proceeds through time in both of these measures during the events that we call global consciousness events. Short events are more powerful than long events, and that's probably a function of the fact that there is a moment in global consciousness space, if you will, which is maybe 2 or 3 hours long. In a human consciousness, it's maybe 200 or 300 milliseconds. That's what the moment in time for us is. But the global consciousness is lumbering along at a different rate. So it takes a little while for the effect to develop, a little, and it maintained for a longer time. The effect is stronger than when we're awake than it is when we're asleep. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. Any consciousness effect should be. But the nice thing about this is that points to the effect that we're talking about as being something that has to do with consciousness. It maximizes, by the way, around dinner time. Not exactly sure why. And its minimum, it comes around 3 in the morning. Some events produce actual negative correlations. I mentioned before that we predict a positive deviation, but sometimes it's strongly negative. There are at least some events where the effect is truly negative, and we're working hard to find out what makes the difference, and that will lead us to more capacity to model and understand what's going on. So ultimately, we asked early on, is there any evidence for this kind of global consciousness or a noosphere for the Earth? And I think there is. And I want to just go through a few points that seem to make that fairly clear. We have demonstrated in laboratory experiments and a variety of other kinds of experiments, and also in this Global Consciousness Project experiment, that consciousness really has a presence in and of itself, in the world. It has a presence. It's not just, it doesn't require that we touch things or read things or talk to other people. Consciousness directly impinges on the world. Consciousness is extended and it's non-local. It is not, as Rupert said earlier today, it's not confined to the skull. It extends out into the world. The data could not come to exist as they do unless that were true. Consciousness is simply not confined to the inside of the body. Humans, we all, are connected at a very deep level. It's not something we can directly perceive. It's a level, maybe on certain kinds of occasions, if we, you know, meet somebody and fall in love, we say, ah, there is something new in the world. But most of the time, we have no direct perception of the interconnection that we clearly have. Mind, because it's not confined to the inner part of your body, inside your head, it can have effects that we have not really imagined, even though there have always been people that said, oh yes, there is telepathy, I can perceive, I do know something about what's going to happen in the future. There is now an increasing amount of scientific evidence that mind has effects we haven't really imagined. When we cooperate, our intention has even more potential for consequences. Of course, they could be negative, but I suspect that most of the time when we're working in consciousness space, it will be positive. When we're coherent, we create noosphere. And I think that, as the sages have said for millennia, we are all one, that we should begin to recognize that oneness is something that we can accept as modern wisdom as well. So I wonder if we're ready, and this is an expression from the Navajo, Southwestern Native Americans. When you put a thing in order and you give it a name and you're all in accord, it becomes. I think this is a perfect expression of the possibility that we have before us, which may also be a responsibility. Now, this is my ending slide. Lots of people think the effects are too small to matter, but if we think about the metaphoric expressions of chaos theory, we ask whether the flap of a butterfly's wing can bring good weather to Germany. And
we hope so.
We hope so, indeed. And if we think so, if we all believe together, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you very much.